Understanding Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder, its impact on the people who live with the disorder, their families, and our communities. If you've been pregnant, chances are your doctor discouraged you from drinking alcohol during your pregnancy. You probably know drinking can cause a range of problems in babies, including fetal alcohol syndrome. But what if you were drinking before you knew you were pregnant? It's very common, and those babies are indeed at risk for a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, or FASD. I'm Jennifer Brooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll learn more about FASD, which remains far too common. Children born with it can have intellectual and emotional disabilities, abnormal facial features, and difficulty learning, among other things. Like many other disorders, early diagnosis can make a huge difference in a child's life. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Fetal alcohol spectrum disorder is a leading cause of developmental disabilities. We've all heard about the dangers of drinking while pregnant. Well, today we're going to discuss just what exactly fetal alcohol spectrum disorder is, how it's diagnosed, and how prevalent it is in Maine. Joining me in our studio, Nancy Cronin. She is the executive director for Maine Developmental Disabilities Council. And Constance Mazelski is the mother of a child with fetal alcohol issues who has become an activist for fetal alcohol prevention, awareness, and understanding. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you have questions about how much alcohol is safe, if any, while pregnant? Do you know someone who has the disorder? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. We'll start the show with Dr. Christopher Pizzullo. He is the state health officer and Maine's chief medical officer for the Medicaid program. He is also a practicing pediatrician. Dr. Pizzullo, welcome to Maine Calling. Dr. Pizzullo, are you there?
Yes, can you not hear me?
Yes, I can now. Thank you very much. Can you start by explaining the very basics? What is fetal alcohol spectrum disorder?
Yep, so fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, or FASD, as it's called for short, is just really a series of changes that can affect babies, fetuses, as they're developing. I wanted to make sure that the listeners knew that there really was no known safe amount of alcohol that could be ingested during pregnancy, and that alcohol can affect a fetus at any time during pregnancy. Some of the types of changes, though, that I think that you're asking me about, certainly there can be abnormal facial features. For example, there can be a thin to almost absent upper lip, as well as a philtrum that's missing. I don't know if you know what a philtrum is. You know that little space between your nose and your upper lip? There's like a dimple that a lot of people have right in there. That's often missing, and it's a really good marker for providers to know if this child may have fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. The things that concern us the most, though, is that many of the children with FASD have brain changes. So they may have poor memory, learning disabilities, speech delays, and they're very likely to have ADHD.
How prevalent is FASD in Maine?
Well, we have prevalence rates for the United States, and it seems that right now about 2 to 5% of the population at any time has FASD. So it isn't something that you grow out of; you essentially have it your entire life. So, in Maine, with our population, that would be at least 25,000 people in Maine.
That's really a lot. Is this one of those things that's often underdiagnosed?
It is often underdiagnosed because it's often very hard to tell if a newborn or a young infant has an FASD spectrum disorder. It's easier to tell after about 12 months. The problem is that one of the best ways to deal with or to treat FASDs is early intervention. So the more quickly that you diagnose it, the more quickly that you can hopefully intervene with either medications to help things like ADHD or behavioral interventions, education and parenting interventions. You really want to diagnose it before the age of 6 if you're going to have a better outcome. And I did want to say that pediatricians and family physicians can diagnose FASD. Sometimes they need a little help with it, and they'll refer children to a developmental pediatrician or to a geneticist.
And finally, Dr. Pizzullo, let's say I'm listening to this program right now, and I'm pregnant. And before I knew I was pregnant, I drank alcohol. What should I do with that information?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. Once you have found out that you're pregnant, please stop using alcohol, because we know that alcohol can affect fetuses at any time and during the entire course of pregnancy. So if you stop, you're still able to hopefully limit the effects that alcohol will have. And the other thing is to let your provider know, your obstetrician or your family practitioner know, so and ultimately the baby's pediatrician, so that you can ensure that that baby gets early and necessary intervention.
Well, Dr. Pizzullo, thank you so much for joining us today. Dr. Christopher Pizzullo is Maine's state health officer. Turning to the guests with me in the studio, Nancy, I'm going to start with you. I read this morning that this is a major cause of developmental disabilities in children.
Oh, absolutely. And it's a major cause of disabilities in adults as well, because you don't grow out of this. Essentially, depending on when the insult happens to your brain, when the mom is pregnant, the brain, that section is affected. If you think about alcohol, when you rub alcohol on your skin, the purpose of rubbing alcohol on your skin is to kill anything it comes in contact with. Alcohol kills cells. So depending on what's happening in the development of the fetus, that is where the alcohol is going to affect.
Mm. Connie, I was wondering if you could tell us your story. When did you discover and how did you discover that your child has an FASD?
Well, we knew when we were deciding to adopt that a lot of children that are adopted, including those overseas or from the foster system, have had fetal alcohol exposure. But we didn't really know how common it was or how difficult it would be to diagnose it. So we were aware of it as a concept, but you know, our daughter was so healthy and lively and so wonderful that we didn't really suspect it, and neither did her pediatricians at first. But over time, her behaviors became more and more, you know, difficult, and clearly she wasn't doing well in her environment. And she would have symptoms that were very confusing and behaviors that were confusing. And it was hard to find anybody that could help pinpoint the cause. And therefore, she didn't get early intervention. And, you know, it took, you know, literally until she was 14 years old to get a confirmed diagnosis of fetal alcohol.
Wow. Nancy, how common is that story?
Oh, incredibly common. In fact, well, actually, there's one piece that's not common. Connie has figured out that her child has fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. What is more common is behaviors happen or developmental issues happen, and we label children with other disorders like ADHD or oppositional defiant disorder or learning disabilities, and we don't actually find out that it's because of FASD. And there's a problem with that. And the problem is that treatments that might work for ADHD, if the root cause is FASD, it won't work. So we're spending a lot of time trying to treat something, and we're treating the wrong thing.
How old is your daughter now, and how is she doing?
She's doing great. She's 15, and you know, we were able to use the diagnosis to help us understand what schooling she should have, how to modify her environment so she can succeed in it. But a lot of damage was done by the late diagnosis. You know, living in a community where the schools don't understand it, where doctors would say she doesn't have facial features, so therefore she doesn't have fetal alcohol exposure. So, you know, so stop talking about it. That's not it. It's very damaging, and it's isolating because people see you as a parent. They see your child, you know, having symptoms like autism, ADHD, other things, sensory issues, and they don't understand that, you know, maybe your parenting style has to be different because your child is different, that you're not just being lax, but you've come to an understanding of what your child needs in order to succeed in their world.
And if we're looking at what Dr. Pezzullo said, 2 to 5% of the population, that is a lot of children. That's a lot of people out there, either trying to find the wrong diagnosis or trying to live in a society that may not understand what's going on. Yeah.
And I would like to say, it's not that these other diagnoses are necessarily incorrect, but it's not the full picture. My daughter does have ADHD, and she's gotten interventions around that, and she's learned in many ways how to work with that. But there's more, you know, there's so much more to it. And, you know, a child with fetal alcohol issues, they can be cooperating their very best, and it looks oppositional. Like a child can, say, have a fit on and refuse to go to school, and you'll ask them, like, why is it that you're acting like this? And they'll say, it's because of my watch band. And you'll say, well, what's wrong with your watch band? And they said, well, you know, it needs to be tighter. And, you know, they'll literally overreact in, like, very confusing ways. And you'll realize that they're trying to, they need their watch because they need to keep track of their school day and they want to cooperate. And they know they're not allowed to look at their phone in school. So, you know, what looks like oppositional behavior can be them trying their hardest to be, you know, a good student and a good kid.
Nancy, if someone's listening to Connie right now and thinking, oh, my gosh, that sounds like a child in my life, who do they call?
Well, they call their doctor and ask for a referral to a psychologist, and hopefully that psychologist has some knowledge about fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. It's a tough question because there's no guarantee that in this state or in this country they're going to land to the right person who's going to be able to know how to help. That's one of the reasons why this is such a problem. For fetal alcohol spectrum disorder to affect so many folks, and we don't even really have a true diagnosis that is recognized and a treatment method to be recognized, is a real problem.
On the line with us now, Dr. Carl Bell. Dr. Bell is an expert in fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. Welcome to the show, Dr. Bell.
Sounds like a good one so far.
Tell us a little bit about the history of our awareness of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. I remember, I think, maybe 40 years ago, a big surge of information coming out, but really, it's been pretty quiet since then.
Well, it actually can be found in the Bible, Book of Judges 13, where an angel goes to Samson's mother and tells her, don't drink. So people have been aware of it, but it wasn't actually identified in the U.S. until 73. And then in 1996, the Institute of Medicine published a book on fetal alcohol syndrome, which is the worst of the disorders. There's syndrome and spectrum disorders. Spectrum disorders, to some extent, being milder, although people disagree about that. But they finally got on it in 96. Everybody was very, very aware of it. The public health people started telling women, if you're pregnant, don't drink. Of course, the problem is half the pregnancies, women don't know they're pregnant. My research shows that most of the women I see don't know they were pregnant. They were doing social drinking. So nobody's accusing women of being alcoholics. They were doing social drinking for the first month or two before they found out they were pregnant. When they found out they were pregnant, they stopped drinking and then found themselves with a child that they had to take care of for most of their adult lives.
Dr. Bell, it sounds, you know, half of women who become pregnant don't know and are drinking.
Right.
How does somebody with this information get a sense, you know, your child is born beautiful and healthy and maybe you, like you said, drank socially during the first month of your pregnancy before you knew? How do you know? What do you look for to see if your child may need help?
Well, as previously mentioned, it's kind of hard to identify, but there are some early childhood signals, prematurity, low birth weight. Those kinds of things might tip you off. It's also, I think, important to understand that there is research going on in this issue. And there's a guy, Robert Friedman, at the University of Colorado, also the publisher of the Journal of American Psychiatric Association, who has some hard evidence that if you give pregnant women enough choline, because what happens with alcohol when you drink it and you're pregnant, it denatures choline.
So choline. C-O-L-I-N-E?
C-H-O-L-I-N-E, choline. It's a nutrient. It's almost a vitamin B. And in fact, in 98, the Institute of Medicine's Nutrition Committee found out that you need about 500 milligrams of choline a day for an average daily requirement. And women especially need it because the brain needs it to develop. Well, Friedman's work shows that if you give women an adequate dose of choline, 500 milligrams a day, you can prevent, he believes, autism, ADHD, and schizophrenia.
Interesting. Dr. Bell, well, I have you on the phone with us. And before I let you go, I want to read you a question somebody asks on Facebook. This is from Lisa. Is this a genetically predisposed syndrome? I was born in 1962. My mother drank and smoked through all three of her pregnancies, and we're all normal. How come some children turn out okay and some suffer?
Well, the research that John May has done in South Africa and other places, and other people have done, Zissel in Carolina, part of it, they're protective factors. So if you have good nutrition, if you have a lot of choline in your diet, it might prevent this from happening. One of the problems is, of the 75 top prenatal vitamins, two only have 50 milligrams of choline. Six have 30 milligrams of choline, and the rest have none. And again, the average daily requirement is about 450. So we were able to get the American Medical Association to put forth a resolution requesting that the prenatal vitamin companies put enough choline in their prenatal vitamin. And probably as this continues, what you will see is that choline will be on the shelves as much as omega-3 is, but that's going to take a little while.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Carl Bell is retired professor of psychiatry and public health at the University of Illinois at Chicago and former director of the Institute for Juvenile Research. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And on that note, I just made the mistake of looking at the clock, and I know I have to take a break already. So when we come back, your comments and questions, we're talking about fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible. Thanks for your support.
On the next Fresh Air, Lena Waithe, creator of the Showtime series The Chi, set in the South Side of Chicago. Last year, Waithe became the first African-American woman to win an Emmy for writing for a comedy series, for co-writing the Thanksgiving episode of Aziz Ansari's series Master of None, the episode in which Waithe's character comes out to her mother. It's based on Waithe's experience. Join us.
And join us for Fresh Air tonight at 7 o'clock, right here on Maine Public Radio. You know, there's almost nothing like the beauty of Iceland, with its black sands, midnight sun, and unique culture. If you've ever thought about visiting Iceland, you can join Maine Public Travel this June from the 17th through the 23rd. We'll visit natural phenomena like geothermal pools and spectacular waterfalls. Plus, our own Jennifer Rooks will host a talk show at ROOF, that's Iceland's public broadcasting organization. For more information, please visit mainepublic.org and click Education. Or call 1-877-479-7040. Again, that's 1-877-479-7040. And thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Understanding Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder. With me in our studio, Nancy Cronin. She is Executive Director of the Maine Developmental Disabilities Council. And Constance Mazelski is an activist for fetal alcohol prevention and the mother of a child with fetal alcohol issues. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I'd like to follow up with you two on what Dr. Carl Bell was talking about before the break and this recommendation that women who may have had something to drink before they knew they were pregnant take choline. Connie, you said this may be helpful even after a baby is born.
Yes, there's a researcher called Dr. Jeffrey Wozniak at University of Minnesota, and he works in the community as well as doing research, and he's found that he believes that there's protective effects that you could actually improve brain function by giving FASD kids choline. So this is radical because it used to be people thought, well, there's nothing you can do about it, so why even bother to diagnose this? But it seems like there are some things you can do about it.
So this is really emerging research right now.
It is.
Yeah, it's really cutting-edge research. And I don't remember exactly how much, but I believe two egg yolks or two eggs is the equivalent of 500 milligrams. So simply adding eggs to the diet might infuse choline. Choline builds brains. Where alcohol takes it away, choline builds. So it's very exciting research.
I have an email from Ellie. I have always been curious about the effects of alcohol during breastfeeding. Do we know if that contributes to FASD? We don't know. You guys are both. Hopefully, maybe. Go ahead.
Well, we know that it's not during the fetal time. Breastfeeding is when we have an infant. I don't know the answer.
Okay. And an email from John, and this may be the same thing. Can a man's drinking cause FASD?
That is something that is also emerging. It used to be they just thought that it was the environment in the woman's uterus, but they realized that it can affect a man's sperm. And so therefore, yes, fathers should stop drinking as well.
Or potential fathers, sounds like. Yeah,
exactly.
For such an important topic, you would think there would be more research about this. But in some ways, the research is just happening now. We're at the very beginnings of understanding FASD, which is frustrating and yet positive. For a substance that is so ingrained in our culture, perhaps there was some fear of looking into it. But now we are finally looking into it, and I can't wait to find out what the next year will bring.
We're going to go to Samantha, who's calling from Bangor. Hi, Samantha. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. It sounds like you have kind of started to touch on my question, which is you were talking about how important it is to diagnose early for treatment. What exactly is treatment, either early or later on in the child's life?
Well, this is Connie Mazelski. There's a couple of main things that can be done. One is there's a social worker who's also the birth mother of children with fetal alcohol in Alaska called Diane Malbin, and she's written a book that's really kind of the gold standard called Trying Differently Rather Than Harder. And you can get it on Amazon. And she basically says that she takes a narrow behavioral approach toward parenting or teaching children with fetal alcohol. They can do very, very well if they're given the chance to succeed. And a lot of that looks like simplifying their environment, understanding how their brains work, not punishing behaviors that are out of their control, understanding that a lot of them have sensory issues and that, you need to be aware of. And, they also tend to confabulate, which can look like lying. So there's a lot of things you can do to help these children succeed, even from a very, very young age.
The idea is, this is Nancy Cronin, instead of directly looking at the behavior, a number of the researchers have talked about, instead of treating the behavior, you're learning to how do you accommodate. You're teaching how to accommodate the brain deficit. So, for example, if we take the example of having poor sight, an individual who cannot see particularly well or not be able to, they might not have trouble reading. And then if you bring glasses into the equation, all of a sudden those problems go away. Same kind of thought process. When you identify what the individual is having trouble with, then you're building the coping skills or the accommodations around that person so that challenging behavior doesn't have to happen.
Samantha, thanks so much for your phone call. We're going to move on now to Dr. Margaret Riley. She's a geneticist at Eastern Maine Medical Center who works with children affected by fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. Dr. Riley, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
And, you know, I'm going to start with a question from one of our audience members. This is JP sent in an email, Dr. Riley, saying that the physician on the program mentioned oftentimes children with suspected FASD would be referred to a geneticist. What exactly is the genetic component of the disease?
So as geneticists, we see children and adults affected by conditions that may have occurred in utero, whether it's a toxin such as alcohol or a chromosome difference that can cause differences or learning difficulties in childhood. So we do see babies that are exposed to different substances in utero because we are familiar with the different features that can present and how to diagnose those particular diagnoses.
What is going on biologically to cause fetal alcohol spectrum disorder when the fetus is exposed to alcohol?
So when the fetus is exposed to alcohol, the alcohol preferentially affects the frontal part of the brain development as well as the facial development, and it affects growth of the fetus as well. And those things can lead to the facial features that we can recognize in childhood, the decreased growth rates and small head circumferences that we often see, and can also affect the different behaviors and the learning that the frontal part of the brain is really involved in.
You know, a lot of pregnancy books, very well-respected pregnancy books, will say that toward the very end of your pregnancy, it's okay to have a glass of wine or something to relax. Is that thinking changed? Is there any safe amount at any point in a pregnancy?
So the fetal brain continues to develop all the way through pregnancy. So there is no safe amount or timing of alcohol use by a mother. Even though people feel like once the pregnancy is more advanced, the brain is well formed, that brain continues to form all the way through pregnancy and then into childhood and young adulthood.
All right. What do you wish doctors knew, other pediatricians and OBGYNs, What do you wish they knew that the message is not out there right now?
Well, I think you brought up a very good point that there is no safe amount of alcohol anytime during pregnancy. A lot of women don't find out that they're pregnant until 4, 6, 8 weeks into pregnancy when there's already been a lot of development going on with the fetus. So I think that being understanding that if a woman has had alcohol during pregnancy, it's often not done on purpose or with intent, and taking that sensitive matter into account when you're working with women who may have consumed alcohol during pregnancy.
All right. Well, Dr. Riley, thank you so much for joining us today. Dr. Margaret Riley, a geneticist at Eastern Maine Medical Center. We'll move to Charlene calling from Wells. Hi, Charlene. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. I have a comment. First of all, I'd like to thank you for covering this topic. There's an incredible community that are raising children that are affected by this, and I am one of them. And I would like to hopefully focus a little bit more, and I hope you're going to, on the kids that a lot of us are raising with these problems, because they range, you know, from very low functioning to high functioning, and it's incredibly difficult to even get a diagnosis. It's incredibly difficult to get schools to understand what this is. We have fought every minute to get our child a proper diagnosis, and then we have fought the schools. I've had to literally give educators handouts that I've printed off the internet because they don't understand what it is. I don't think that they're exposed to a lot of kids that have fetal alcohol syndrome. And I guess my question is, how, as parents, do we educate our communities? How do we educate our educators? How do we get this out there? Because I think a lot of kids, like you said, they're just labeled with something else, and people just don't understand and they don't know how to deal with them.
Well, Charlene, as you've been talking, both of our guests have been nodding, so I'll let them both respond. Go ahead, Connie. Nancy.
I think you hit it right on the head. How do we get people to start acknowledging fetal alcohol spectrum disorder for what it was for the people who are alive today? And the big thing that has to happen is, one, we need to acknowledge this is real. And it doesn't necessarily look one way for one kid, and that's what it is. So this is a spectrum disorder. It can look very different for lots of people. And we need right now in our state, if you want services, then rarely fetal alcohol spectrum disorder is not a pathway to get it. These other diagnoses are more like pathways to get it. We need recognition that fetal alcohol spectrum disorder might be the cause of the disorder and might be a huge component of the issue. And we need professionals to acknowledge it and start figuring out how to treat it. I wish I could say that as a parent, you're going to walk into a professional's office or classroom and they're going to know what to do. But I suspect that's going to be quite rare. And for a while, you're going to be the one educating.
Connie.
Yes, it is quite rare to find a professional that's educated and up to speed on fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. Some are familiar with fetal alcohol syndrome. But that's the far end of the spectrum. And ironically, a lot of kids that are higher functioning wind up doing less well in life. Because if you have an average or better IQ, you can have all the other aspects of fetal alcohol, and yet you don't get services, you don't get identified. And, you know, there is a way of evaluating what they call adaptive functioning. But most psychologists don't even know to administer that to people that may, you know, you may suspect have fetal alcohol. So what you wind up finding is there'll be people that get through elementary school very well. Their sort of academic career peaks in elementary school. Their behaviors get more and more problematic. School gets harder and harder. They graduate and they don't understand concepts like time, money management. They want to do well, but they don't know how to, you know, to read a bus schedule and catch the bus. They've got, you know, they're able to get a job but not keep it because they just don't show up consistently. And there's just nothing out there to help the kids and help the families develop these skills they need.
Charlene, thanks so much for your call. Is there a state or a place that's doing it right, that's a template for others to follow?
Yes, there is. I'm glad you asked that. There is an excellent annual conference in Minnesota. It's been going on for 6 years. And I went year before last, and that was an amazing awakening for me, because I realized that there are people out there that understand fetal alcohol and what to do about it. There's pockets of awareness around the country in different places. In Alaska, there's a lot of people that are familiar with it. In Washington State, where fetal alcohol syndrome was originally identified, there's a huge number of professionals, social workers, psychiatrists, psychologists, and in Canada in general, there's a lot of awareness about it because, you know, they have the National Health, so they have solid statistics about it. And but in Minnesota, once your child gets diagnosed, usually before the age of 3, you get a caseworker who's, they're called a community engagement coordinator around fetal alcohol, and they make sure the parents get educated. They put you in touch with the right resources, and you know, they start you on your journey with supports. And that's the only place I know of that has this sort of built-in ability to support the kids and families.
An email from Kate. The top headline in the Portland Press Herald is about the number of babies in Maine born addicted to opioids. What are some similarities between opioid babies and FASD babies?
I wish Dr. Pizzullo or one of the doctors was
okay. This is Connie. I will say that there's a huge overlap because from what I understand from having gone to some conferences, if a birth mother is addicted to substances and she can't get a hold of them, she will probably drink because alcohol is readily available, you know, everywhere and always. So the comorbidity is very, very high. And it's great news. I saw that in the paper today, that the incidence of drug-addicted babies is going down, but that doesn't mean the incidence of alcohol-addicted babies or alcohol-affected babies is going down.
And I think one difference that we might highlight is that the babies that are born opiate-addicted are going through withdrawals, while if there has also been an insult due to alcohol done in the brain, that's going to be a lifelong insult. That is not something that you would necessarily withdraw from. That's an injury. And I, since marijuana is such a hot topic now, I would also say that marijuana ingested while pregnant does affect, or smoked or whatever, vaped, does affect the fetus as well, and passes on through breast milk.
We're discussing fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We do have to take another quick break, but before we do so, a word about tomorrow's program. Well-known outdoorsman George Smith joins us to discuss his recent ALS diagnosis. If you have a question or comment for him, please email it or send it to us ahead of time. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Patriot Subaru, providing sales, service, and accessories on new and pre-owned all-wheel drive Subarus on Route 1 in Saco.
An anti-abortion group is trying a new tactic, convincing healthcare workers who perform abortions to quit.
I just woke up one Monday morning and I was like, this is it. Today is the day.
Abortion rights supporters say it's making a tough job tougher.
It's just another stressor on people who are already going to work in a highly charged political environment.
That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered every weekday evening from 4 to 6:30 right here on Maine Public Radio. And stay with us at 2 o'clock after Maine Calling for ideas from the CBC. Today, Ideas takes a look at the politics of the professoriate. Universities often serve as venues for the exchange of ideas, but some people now say that they skew so far to the left that they are political monocultures. Voices that stray too far from liberal orthodoxy become silenced. Ideas looks at the complex questions behind political diversity on campus. That's at 2 o'clock on Ideas from the CBC on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, I'm understanding fetal alcohol syndrome disorder, spectrum disorder. With me in the studio, Connie Mazelski. She is a mother of a child with fetal alcohol issues. And Nancy Cronin is the executive director for the Maine Developmental Disabilities Council. If you'd like to join our conversation, please call 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Nancy, one of the things we really haven't talked about yet is the fact that a lot of young people with FASD experience stigma.
Oh, absolutely. In some ways, that when you hear FASD, you are blaming your mother. This happened to me, and that's really not fair. Or in different situations, perhaps maybe it is. Let's strip down a little bit and look at our culture and what we do on the weekends. There's people who go ice fishing. There's people who go snowmobiling. There's people who go to microbreweries or wine tasting. Alcohol is extremely prevalent in our culture. And fetal alcohol spectrum disorders is unfortunately also very prevalent at this moment. It's a bit ironic that there's this huge stigma about it because somehow it's associated to abuse. And that might not be the truth. It simply might be an individual had a drink and they didn't know they were pregnant. And they were just living in the culture that we're in. And there's a bit of fear about it. We have to move past that stigma so that we can truly help these children and adults and also help them realize, one, moms blame themselves when there is something wrong with their kids. It's inevitable for I've worked with moms of children with autism for many, many years. And almost all of them wonder, what did I do? As soon as you hear that your child might have a challenge, you think, what do you do? What did I do? Fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, you know what happened. You just might not have known when it happened or that you weren't doing it consciously. We have to move past that stigma. We have to move to forgiveness and past so we can take care of the people who are alive today and accommodate and create a world in which they can share their gifts.
Connie, has your daughter experienced what she perceives as stigma?
Well, yes, absolutely. The behaviors that you see with some of the kids with fetal alcohol issues can be very confusing and very out of sync with, you know, what you expect kids' behaviors to be. So, for example, even in a school district that's understanding and not punitive around kids that behave different, they don't necessarily understand why the kid behaves this way. So they'll think the kid is, like, seeking attention or acting out. And also, because of the brain damage, a kid may be able to understand something one day and the next day not be able to recall it. And to teachers, that looks like defiance or, you know, trying to be a class clown, when really they just genuinely cannot retrieve the information that day. So that's one type of thing that, you know, most kids with fetal alcohol issues encounter. And another thing is just on a community basis, you know, if it were a different type of traumatic brain injury, then people would understand and rally. In our town, there was a wonderful girl who, I think she slipped on the ice, or maybe she had some other issue. And everyone rallied to support her family and, you know, to pray that she got better and raise funds. But if you've got brain damage from, you know, from something that's hidden, people aren't going to tie strings around their tree trunks, and they're not going to raise funds, and they're not going to even understand, you know, why your kid acts the way they do and why you parent the way you do. And that can be very isolating. And so I would encourage, you know, people out there, you know, be more understanding and tolerant. If there's a child that's not doing well, then, you know, even if you can't put your finger on why that is, try to, you know, lend some support instead of just judgment.
We'll go to Scott, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Scott. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. How are you? Hey, I just wanted to relay some information to provide more spectrum to a statement that was made a few minutes ago. I have worked with a number of mothers going through pregnancy who have managed seizures with cannabis, alternately to using things like phenobarbital and Dilan, which they felt were more dangerous to their fetus. I would just note that all those children were born healthy and all tested negative for any contents of cannabinoids, as in the proper name for marijuana. So don't want to argue the point, but would just note that Maine Med, Mercy, and CMMC all found that those children were born without any trace of THC or any other cannabinoid in their system. So that, combined with some studies that show that marijuana is safe for pregnancy, especially in conditions where you're weighing options like dealing with seizures and the potential damage that could do, as well as the drugs that cause seizures or prevent seizures, you know, what those alternate options are, the dangers of those, that, you know, if you combine all that information, I think it gives a little bit different picture than was stated previously.
Okay. Scott, yeah, thanks for your call. And I think that you're talking about a group of people who are being very closely supervised by a doctor and not someone who's using marijuana recreationally, which is, I think, a different. You're nodding,
yeah,
Nancy.
Absolutely.
Okay, there's a good question here. Oh, this is from Martha. As an IDD registered nurse and health coach, I'm happy to hear that choline was mentioned on this program. Can you go into more depth about other foods in the importance of nutritious eating versus what the majority of the American population eats, the standard American diet, better known as SAD? Can changing the general diet potentially help someone with FASD?
I can speak from the mother's perspective. I'm also part of a group of parents that have connected through Facebook to try to share tips and ideas about how to help their kids. I can't speak from a you know, clinical basis, but a lot of people have found that removing some like dyes from the diet help. Minimizing sugar can help with behaviors, according to some of the folks. Omega-3s have been helpful. But There's not been a consensus. Like, you will not go to a pediatrician and they'll say, you know, your child needs this roster of supplements. Dr. Carl Bell, who was on earlier, he actually, I've heard him speak, and he's amazing because he'll say, you know, here's what is research-based, and here's what I would do if I were a parent. Here's the type of supplements I would give to my kid. So you can look online and find a lot of useful information, and it's worth a try.
All right. I want to talk about how this, maybe move this out to a little bit of a bigger picture, how the prevalence of FASD affects our culture. I read this morning that it's believed that more than half of the people who are in prisons probably suffer FASD. Is that your understanding?
That does not surprise me. There's some figures from Canada that I've seen ranging anywhere from 60 to 73% of Canadian prisoners, they believe, are fetal alcohol exposed. And, you know, some of the types of brain damage, it can result in black and white thinking, difficulty understanding the consequences of one's actions, having difficulty figuring out, you know, the future, and being very suggestible. So, you know, fetal alcohol young adults, they so want to be accepted, they so want friends, they can very easily be rejected by neurotypical folks and fall in with, you know, people that want to just, you know, use them. And, you know, if there is some sort of criminal activity, they're the ones that are going to get caught. They're not going to be shrewd, or they're not going to know what to say to the policeman to talk their way out of something. So it does not surprise me that that figure would be so high.
Yeah, and what I would add is I think that's a really big indication of us not identifying fetal alcohol spectrum disorder early enough and treating it appropriately. We don't do it particularly well for children who have challenging behaviors. What we need to do is identify challenging behaviors, find the cause, and wrap around ways to teach an individual how to accommodate and act differently, how to recognize their strengths and weaknesses, how to learn what to do with social skills, how to act in different ways when you're feeling impulsive, and really use positive behavioral supports a lot more. The fact that we are letting things go so long is setting up behaviors in which individuals are going to just, they're going to do things, they're going to get in trouble, they're going to become risk aversive, they're going to have a higher rate of poor outcomes of either criminal activity or even drug abuse or other issues that are going to negatively impact their life.
Are there rehab facilities? Are there places for people with a diagnosis to go that specialize in FASD?
Not that I know of, no. And it wouldn't be appropriate to have a rehabilitation center, and everything is so, because you're not rehabilitating from a brain injury.
Mm.
You're identifying what is the injury in the brain and then figuring out what needs to be done to accommodate that injury. Just like if you have low vision, then you put glasses on, but you have to learn that you need glasses, that it will help. So first you identify what is the state of the brain and how it impacts your life in a negative ways, and what tool can you use, like glasses, to be able to actually make the life better and more functional.
Yeah. And taking the larger view, as you said, you know, the life outcomes for a lot of people with fetal alcohol issues, especially ones that haven't gotten appropriate interventions, can be very dark, very bad. I've heard that as many as 85% of people with fetal alcohol can never live completely independently. The good news is the brain continues to develop. So, you know, a fetal alcohol exposed person at age 20 may have more like the maturity and skills of somebody who's, you know, 11, 12, or 13. But the brain is very plastic, and they can continue to develop skills and maturity and self-discipline, you know, well into their 20s and even 30s. So there is a lot of hope, but there's such a lack of awareness out there that you want to make sure people don't get imprisoned before they have a chance to develop, you know, the judgment and self-control they're going to need.
And if I may, I think it's really important to note that the brain doesn't stop growing or developing until you die. Yeah, your brain.
And this is really fairly recent knowledge.
Yes. It is. You're, the assumption that the brain changes and develops until you're 26, it's not true. Even 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds, 60-year-olds, 70-year-olds, their brain is still developing. And I have seen research, for instance, in stroke victims or individuals with brain injury in which they've lost the ability to move their right hand with intense work. They have been able to gain those skills again, building new pathways through different areas of the brain. That's the exciting part about this. It's not static. It's not, you catch it when the child is before three and it's, or it's over. That's not true. There is always hope. There's always something you can do. The biggest thing that I'm hoping that people will hear out of this is we need to get people talking about it. We need to reduce the stigma, and we need to increase professionals' willingness to do something and learn and treat.
Connie, what are your hopes?
Well, my hope is that people will become more aware of the strengths of many people with fetal alcohol and help them build on them and create, you know, useful, happy lives. A lot of fetal alcohol people are very creative. They tend to be loyal and hardworking, and you know, they can develop habits of success, and they just need supports and you know, there's a concept of the external brain. So some folks are just going to need a little bit of outside help, and they can do just fine in life and succeed and thrive.
All right. Well, thank you both for being here on Maine Calling today. You just heard from Connie Mazelski. She's the mother of a child with fetal alcohol issues and is active in fetal alcohol prevention. And Nancy Cronin, the executive director for the Maine Developmental Disabilities Council. Roddy Nickpour ran our board today. Owen Manahan took your calls and helped produce today's program. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives, by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's program will be broadcast again tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, outdoorsman and author George Smith joins us to discuss his recent diagnosis of ALS. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.